Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Hello, 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 my great, great audience. I hope that you are enjoying all the wonderful changes on the website, the new stuff. If you haven't in a while, go look at the frequent alerts. Look at my brand new blog site. Now, what's the matter with most blog sites? Well, you don't know the quality, or it's a good site, but it's got 100 people on it, or it's got all kinds of different stuff going on. Well, I'm doing something very simple that you can go to every week or so. It's only going to have a few top-notch bloggers on it. It's my honored guest blog site. It's like an award I give to some of my honored coworkers. And then they get to blog on it whenever they want. And the first person that I chose and who's blogging, brought up a great blog, is Peter Goetze, the great Danish doc, author of Deadly Psychiatry. It's very exciting to me. And I don't plan to have more than 10 or 12 people. We'll just see how it shakes out. But I want you to have a site where you can go to where you know you're going to get uncensored, the cutting edge in our field of mental health, because that's what you deserve, or psychology, sociology, whatever your human science and service is. That's it, human science, sciences and services. I want you to have the best people. So that blog is starting now. It's going to develop more. Peter Goetze wants to do two or three blogs right now because he's got some stuff on his mind. And my second invitee onto the honored guest blogger is my guest today, and it's Michael Corrigan. Michael is a man that everyone should know more and more about. Michael, are you there?
I am.
Ah, you sound good. Michael is an educator. He's an old friend. He is an advocate of children. He is a scientist, a statistician working on children's issues. He does the best presentation on the ridiculousness and horror of the ADHD diagnosis that I've ever seen. He's based in Ohio, so in Columbus. So if you ever want to, or outside of Columbus, he can clear that up. But if you ever want somebody to come and do an ADHD presentation, he is fabulous. I'm not sure what his first blog for us is going to be, but I've asked him to get one up in a few weeks to follow Peter Goetze's blogs. And believe me, it is going to be interesting. So I'm very excited. You might be able to tell. I'm just feeling more and more excited about what I'm doing. I've made a major change on my website. I've decided as of last week to stop being shy about all the great legal work I do. I get so battered for my legal work every time I go into depo, every time I go into trial, because their only hope is to try to batter me because they cannot put up an expert against me. In fact, it's become so bizarre that in my last two trials, maybe three, they've even put up an expert because they didn't want to try to contest the science. They just wanted to try to blow it off. Well, it doesn't work too well for them usually. So what I've done on my website is I've now put up 70 trials and big settlements that are the result of my work. All of them, really, pretty much all my work, except for the giant Eli Lilly $800 million settlement, of which I played a small part. All the others, I'm pretty much it in the trial, or certainly I'm the main consultant and organizer. So it's up. I'm not going to be shy anymore, folks. I do legal work. Some of it makes a lot of money. Some of it doesn't make a lot of money. All of it does good. So if you go up, look at my website, and you'll see on the left-hand column now, it's just a column of about eight or nine of trials and settlements I'm particularly proud of. You hit on that, you can look at 70 of them. So that for the drug companies, and that for the nasty lawyers who will grill me in court, I'm out front. I'm glad to be doing this legal work. I'm glad to be doing it. I'm going to be more and more proud of it, and I'm going to be putting it up on the internet, on my website. You know, folks, everybody has trouble with trauma. Once you're attacked and attacked and attacked, it becomes hard to be proud. Well, I've been attacked and attacked and attacked about the legal, and I've broken out of that. I'm proud. Some of my best work has been in the legal arena, and it's up there on a website now for all the world to see in all its splendor, whereas before I sort of spread the cases out among other things. And I'm just very pleased with how things are going right now, and you can probably hear it in my voice. And my wonderful audience, I hope they're going wonderful with you. Now, speaking of wonderful, we get back to Michael Corrigan. Michael, talk for a few minutes, would you?
What would you like me to talk about today?
Well, I'd like you to start and just talk a little bit about this work you're doing in trauma. And I know you would like to sort of interview me and on some specific issues, which I'm happy to do. But I'd like you to just chat for a couple of minutes about the trauma stuff.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, for years I've been a professor and I teach child development and psychology courses and statistical research and research methods, all that fun stuff. And I mean, most of your audience who knows me knows I wrote Debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging Kids. But what a lot of people don't know about me is I went through a pretty challenged childhood in my life with many touches across the child welfare system. And one of the things I've always wanted to do, because we've been assessing school districts for nearly a decade now, worked with about 150 school districts, helping them study, you know, safety, climate, motivation, all kinds of different things. We do a multidimensional assessment. But one of the directions we wanted to go was working within child welfare. And we, with help of Dr. Robert Foltz and my longtime research partner, Doug Grove, we developed a multidimensional youth assessment 360 system. So it's the MDYA 360, we call it. And what it is a multidimensional assessment of facilities, foster homes, CPS homes under investigation. And it allows us to see how good the care is being provided, the safety, the well-being of the kids, the behavioral challenges, the educational support and parental engagement. And then we can also use that same assessment to look at how each individual youth is doing. And we do that through assessing the youth, having the parents or guardians contribute to the same assessment, as well as the staff that's serving them. And then what we build on top of that is a resource library of like every form they'll need to get through a day, whether it's doing risk assessments or home inspections or psychosocial assessments or doing change of status or placement. And one of the things that we really wanted to make a part of that was a trauma-informed approach. And that is because, you know, it already happens in the real world, in the public sector, in that we're diagnosing behaviors and we're calling them symptoms, and we're assigning a mental disorder to kids and people with not necessarily considering if it might be something else that's causing them to behave in a certain way. Well, with kids and child welfare or juvenile justice, there's a good possibility they've probably had more than four traumatic experiences in their life is what research tells us. So a lot of the symptoms that we're seeing, a lot of the behaviors that we're seeing are typically related to trauma, not necessarily can be contributed to a mental disorder. It's more their behaviors are stemming from what they've experienced in life, what I call their cultural DNA. So what Bob and I have developed is this assessment system, and what we've done is teamed up with a company called Helix Business Solutions. They're a huge partner of Oracle, gold partner, and with Oracle as the other partner. And what we have now is like this mobile, modern, modular, you know, you can caseworkers can go out and use their phones or tablets and collect all this information on site in the field. It's saved in Oracle Cloud. It's instantly accessible. And what we do is we help them collect all the information, all the data they need, and complete all the forms and documentation they need in order to store that. And then the way we've programmed it is so that if they wanted to know everything about a certain youth because that youth was getting ready to be put in residential treatment, maybe moved from juvenile detention to residential treatment or to foster care, they can pull up that youth's portal and press a button, and then they get what we call an integrated care passport. So it's got all the medical history, all the mental health history, all the information about their family, any high risk or serious alerts they need to know about, criminal past, all the assessments that have been completed on them are summarized. So basically what we're trying to do is give everybody in child welfare a way to keep a pulse on every youth so we're not losing kids. You know, you can read headlines every day about kids being lost in foster care. We read recently Kansas, can't figure out where 70 kids in foster care are at. So there's just tons of stuff. And, in New York, we lose kids. I mean, there's so few people working in child welfare. I mean, there's a lot of money spent, but it doesn't employ a lot of staff for the vast number of people they have to manage. So like in New York for a while there, each caseworker in New York City had over 40 kids that they had to monitor. And, if you've ever tried to travel around New York City, that's nearly impossible to see those kids on a weekly basis, if not monthly basis, when you have that many. So what we're really trying to do is take the science that we've used to study kids and diagnose kids and figure out what they need to build these resiliency factors and put it into a technology system that just becomes a real-time way to get everything done and actually be able to track and monitor the outcomes and inform these clinicians as to what's been used before if they're getting mental health help, inform the educators what the past has been, inform the foster folks what has worked in other placement settings. So it's a pretty intensive system we've developed. It's called Vital Child, by the way, and the website's vitalchild.solutions. But we're excited. We just started kicking it off this summer, and our Oracle group is out there telling all the states about it, and we're in the running for a number of states and counties contracts right now.
Well, this is so, so good. Tony Stanton, of course, and Tony is a psychiatrist, folks, that I'm going to have on the air on January 10. He's been on before. And Tony, for much of his career, ran a children's facility in California where the worst of the worst kids came that nobody could help. And he did two very dramatic things. One, he took them off their meds. But that what relates here directly to Michael Corrigan's work with Bob Fultz is that he put on the front of every record, the big steel, I don't know if he had them then, but he had big iron records that were stuck, onto shelves for the nurses to look at and the aides and so on. And he put on the front of every one a history of the child's traumatic past so that's what they'd see every day rather than just thinking of the diagnosis. And, Michael, I think you probably agree with me, but your language didn't. You said that, these kids have trauma, not mental illness. It's all trauma. I'm sure you agree with me on that, don't you? I mean, life suffering is about A, human nature, and B, what human nature goes through growing up and going through society. And that's it.
I would agree, and especially in the case of kids being put through experiences in child welfare, whether it be CPS, residential treatment, foster care. It's just interesting. There's this assessment used in the field called the CANS out of the University of Chicago. And they use anywhere from 3 to 7 items to diagnose if a youth is depressed. And they're giving, and they have a staff member who basically completes it. They don't necessarily have to ask the youth. the staff person, the clinician authorized to do this assessment, completes it. And, you know, my question is, if you were going to do that to every kid that was entering juvenile detention, you know, or a residential treatment facility, they just got pulled out of their home. You know, they've been having issues already. They've just been told they're going to be in juvenile detention for this long, or residential treatment for this long, or foster care for this long. How do you think they're feeling? You know, they're depressed. You don't need to diagnose it. It's not a disorder. It's a result of life, you know. And what we want to look at is not just, you know, it's trauma, but what was the trauma, you know, and what have they been through? Because too often we're sending kids back home to these places not knowing that this trauma even took place, you know, because we're not even diagnosing it in many states. And we need to work with children to create that relationship, that rapport, and get them to trust us and help them realize we're trying to figure out everything that's going on so that we can give them everything they need to get better. Because right now, unfortunately, for the most often is children go into child welfare, and it's rare they'll ever get out. They end up spending, you know, going in and out of crossing paths and touching base with all types of different agencies and facilities and services throughout their whole, you know, childhood. And, you know, our goal is to give these states, these folks working and underpaid folks and overworked folks, you know, the tools and technology that only, you know, Fortune 500 companies could afford years ago. And by having that technology, they're just so much more efficient and effective that they're more informed. You know, they're finally evidence-driven. They're not sending like Bob will tell you, you know, he worked in residential treatment centers for nearly 20 years, and they'd have a new youth show up, and they wouldn't have any information on that youth. So they'd have to start all over again trying to figure it out, right? And then about 3 to 4 days or a week or two later, that hard copy file would finally arrive, and they'd be like, oh, my God. You know, if we would have known this, you know, we would have been doing this, this, and this. So what we're really trying to do is just modernize the approach and bring to light it is trauma. And what can we do to understand the trauma they've been through and help them with that? But also, what can we do understanding the trauma they've been through to stop it from happening again, and making sure they're protected in these homes we're putting them in?
Well, I love everything you're saying, and I don't usually push my books too much on the radio show, but, you know, my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, which is actually my newest book next to Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, really just lays this all out. I've got 2 chapters on the relationship between trauma and abuse and all that we call mental disorders. And the combination of our human vulnerability, which we must never forget. Nobody gets through this earth without some misery. We have all this vulnerability. And but then the experiences, what I call the negative legacy emotions, get stirred up. And it's guilt, it's anxiety, it's shame. And every one of these foster kids has got a load, probably of all three. Certainly anxiety and shame, and if he's been allowed to develop it, he's got guilt as well. And these are universal phenomena. And, you know, one of the things I really like so much about what you're doing is it's going to help shift us to a whole new model that's about trauma, stress, and other difficulties in childhood.
I appreciate it.
So more from you, sir.
Well, today I've been on your show a number of times, and I was telling you on the phone I wanted to do something different today. And I wanted to ask you some questions, if you don't mind. I'd like to play the interviewer today.
I don't mind.
So I was reading one of your articles in your new news alert section on the Bregan.com, and it was called Get Bregan, I think it was called, right?
Yeah.
And it was about how you've challenged psychiatry establishment for decades and sadly, how this article shows that one point inmates of one of the doctors you challenged were promised release from prison by agreeing to receive psychosurgery, like electroshock, right?
Yeah, right.
And the even scarier side of that story is that, as I was reading, I was like, oh, my God, is that the inmates were rumored to have stated that they would harm you, you know, murder you after
yeah.
their release because of the negative, you know, things you said about the dangerous procedures they were receiving, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was just like reading it, and I was just kind of laughing and sighing at the same time. But, you know, supposedly these procedures that are touted by the powers that be to be capable of, you know, fixing this dangerous behavior and these violent offenders, you know, that's what they're claiming at this conference you're at. And yet some undergoing such procedures still felt compelled to make death threats to you. So
we don't know if they actually did. It was actually the neurosurgeon who was saying all this.
Right,
and I think
right.
he was just trying to scare me. But who knows?
Yeah. Well, I just found it interesting because it's like, you know, they're trying to sign a label of effective treatment or insanity. And I'm just not sure how you do that in that situation. But I just want to tell the audience, I mean, I've known you for a number of years now. And we've worked together on a bunch of different projects and stuff. And I know you. And when I hear you talk, I'm like, I'm touched and I'm inspired. But at the same time, I know that, you know, you've rattled some cages, right, along the way. You've made a few people mad. You've challenged them, right? And, you know, you read a story like that one about the Git Bragan, that people are actually out to get you. I was just like, God, you know, how do you do it, Peter? You know, but yet you're,
yeah.
here you are 40 some plus years later, still speaking out and being that voice, you know, and as the thing at the beginning of the show says, you know, the voice or conscience of psychiatry. And that I think you are. But I think most sane, I'm going to diagnose you right now because I think most sane, rational, reasoning individuals would have went into hiding long ago, you know, if they were you.
Yeah,
and but you're still out there sharing your voice and treating clients, you know. And I that's why I want to spend my time with you today. And I'm like myself and so many others. I just want to say thank you. It's insane what you do.
Well, you know, I didn't know that's where we were going, but that's thank you so much. And I want to say that that particular episode of. That I described on the website of the neurosurgeon standing up at a conference and saying, "I'm Peter, I'm worried about you, the prisoners I'm working with." I think it was at Vacaville, you know, on who are lifers or on death row. They're going to, you know, they can't get my psychosurgery. And the word is the first one out, get Bragan. That was not anywhere near the worst stuff that happened.
Oh, I'm and sure.
So I'm going to try to talk about that on and off. Occasionally, maybe in another few weeks, on my frequent alerts or on the website. I haven't talked about it before. It's a part of this new me, which says I'm getting more and more out front about who I am and what I do. And it's just a feeling about myself that right now, which is so interesting at age 81, that I kind of have these new inspired feelings. I'm so grateful to God that Ginger and I are both alive, that we're both well, and that we're getting weller on our new nutrition as well. So, I mean, it's interesting for you to ask that. But I know that both Ginger and I, because Ginger, that stuff I went through without Ginger, that's BG before Ginger. But Ginger, since she was a child, was a reformer. And there's no way to explain why. No one in her family is a... you know, takes big risks reforming, although her parents were Isaac Walton League environmental type people, middle of the road environmentalists, very active in the church and the community. Certainly nothing like this, although they did encourage her. And when she was a kid, she actually got the local animal shelter shut down and rebuilt. By the time she was 16, she took on the mayor and ousted the old mayor working with a new candidate. And I mean, extraordinary for a young woman, a child. And I always was a person who stood up for my friends, no matter how big you were, and that told the teachers what I thought. even though I wasn't an outsider, I was really an insider in the school. You know, I had very good friends and held class offices and stuff. So, and even played ball. So, I mean, I don't know what to make out of it other than from early on, I thought that I was here to do something and make it a better place.
I just, when I was reading it, I was, you know, reading the article and I'd like get bragging it. It caught me at first, but then as I read more and started thinking about still where we're at and still how many people are being medicated and you know, what's going on, I thought, well, luckily they never did get bragging, but unfortunately they still don't get bragging, you know, you know, but that's the reality, right? But they need to get bragging. By get bragging, I mean it's time some folks open their minds and at least try to listen and consider the truths and the science that, you know, rest in the messages you share. And it's just interesting when you run into some people, they might think you're this, you know, outrageously spoken man on a mission, and you are, but you're not playing the role of Chicken Little. I mean, there's plenty of, you know, research and facts to show that what you're sharing is the truth, you know. And I've just been trying to figure out, you know, for years now, why is this still going on? Why aren't people hearing this message? Why aren't people, you know, listening to the facts and the studies that show that these, you know, drugs are dangerous? But at the same time, you know, so I'm just trying, I was trying to, like, process it. And I told you recently, you know, I lost one of my best friends in August too. He had massive trouble with insomnia, and they ended up getting him on a cocktail stuff, and he took his life. And you know, here I am, an author and a doctor who talks about that stuff, and I was like, oh my God, it hit so close to home. And I was just reminded again in the last few months of what was going on there. But it's like I wish that doctor that treated my friend could have. Understood this, you know, and I don't know if they don't understand or if they don't care. But then recently, I, you know, this therapist friend of mine was talking to me, who knows you and I are friends, and you know, she was telling me that, you know, when she feels down and alone during a day of seeing, you know, half dozen clients or whatever she has to do in the clinic, you know, these folks with these serious life, you know, real trauma issues, she finds herself frustrated with this over medication practices, you know. And what she does is she really doesn't have anybody to talk to in that clinic where she works. So she visits your website and watches videos and reads articles. And I thought, you know, that should be the resource you are for so many people. And the question is, why aren't more people reaching out to you? You know, because this is someone who needs, you know, assistance. And why would she be the only therapist in there who has this issue, right? She actually told me that one of the psychiatrists she works with, when she was complaining about it, said, well, if you don't want your clients to be medicated, then don't send them to me, because that's what I do. So we've gotten to a point in psychiatry and psychology and, you know, therapy, mental health, where, you know, there's just not a lot of voice of reason. And I think we just need to, you know, get to the next stage. And so that's what I'm after is... And what I've realized is that, you know, people don't necessarily want to sit down and read a book. I don't want to hurt your feelings. I've just realized over the years, being a professor, it's hard to get students to read books. It's hard to get, you know, I've definitely had more video views on YouTube at debunking ADHD than I sold books, right? But I was trying to think about, and I know you've written a small library of books, you know, addressing the questions I wanted to ask you today. But I was trying to think, you know, what if we could get together, like, you know, seven questions that could give folks like this therapist I know in mental health some great things to consider, you know, as they go through the day and they just want to make a change, but they don't. You know, I'm trying to figure out what we can do to finally truly get them to get breaking. Okay? So...
Well.
Maybe that's the name of your next book, Get Breaking. Let me ask you a couple questions because I think...
Although I do have three projects going on.
Yeah.
You know, I agree with you so much that people aren't reading books. you can see the amount of energy and enthusiasm I'm putting into my website, because my wife has been telling me for years, Ginger, people aren't reading books.
Yeah.
So I have blogs all the time where individual blogs outperform my books.
Oh, I agree. So I agree. I just think, and I'm thinking along these lines. I've ran into a number.
But
of
I like your idea.
Yeah.
Let's figure out how to do something like that on probably a video, not even a blog, a video that would do that.
Yeah. So and here's
a video
here's
for therapists. Well, I'm going to be doing it anyway because my partner in so many things now, in addition to Ginger, is Pam Coulter, who's in your Pam Popper, who's in your town area. And we're going to be doing a training course on empathic therapy, and that's going to deal with that a lot. And we also have a training course that's now out that people can join when it starts again in a few months. Right now it's mostly up on Pam Popper's website. I got to get it up on mine, which is why and how to stop taking psychiatric drugs. And it addresses all these issues. But I think you're right. It would be really good to do something that's like, you know, 7 answers about psych drugs that every therapist needs to know. You're thinking of something like that, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it seems something more. I think some of them just need the information so that they can put their foot down or start a conversation in these clinics and these agencies that they work in, right? So let me throw one out at you real quick. First question, okay? I hear it all the time, but how would or should a clinician wanting to slow down the pharmaceutical freight train's momentum, you know, dispute the claim to insurance companies or to their clinic's management that they are ethically required to medicate for a mental disorder? Right? How should a clinician tell those folks that that's not true?
Well, the first thing that clinician has to do is set up a backup private practice. That is an absolute necessity. I've talked about this for years. It is impossible to be absolutely straightforward about these issues in a modern clinic. Now, I do have a friend who's a psychiatrist who consults actually to a hospital ward, but you wouldn't want me mentioning her name, and she manages to nudge things along. But if you're going to actually confront these issues, you have to be prepared to get fired. And you should be aligning with other people. You should be going on my website. You should be going on MIA.com, on Bob's website, Mad in America, where Bob, incidentally, folks, has, as I do, many good blogs. If you're going to do a direct discussion with these people, you probably need to give them something scientific looking, and you could certainly, from my books, if it's about antidepressants, you could give them the small antidepressant fact book or the ADHD talking back to Ritalin. You know, you could give them one of the little paperbacks. They don't cost much online. You can get them secondhand, or you can buy them from us. But they probably won't read it. You could give them my most concise article, which you can download for free off my website, and which is actually up at the top of the website under selected highlights, is Rational Psychopharmacology, which explains everything I'm saying in one article. You could send people some of my YouTube stuff or some of your YouTube stuff. But I think the more fundamental issue is that if you're going to confront somebody with an institution, they'll be even bolder than the psychiatrist who told your friend, don't send anybody to me. They'll say, get out of here. Get out of the facility.
Well, I think it would.
Let me just finish. Some people do manage to go about doing stuff, but they don't do it through the psychiatrist. And every ethical therapist has the right to give information to patients. You have a right to say, read this book and make up your own mind, look at this article and make up your own mind. And you also have, I believe, an ethical obligation to say there are a lot of questions about these drugs. I think that. Now, you might get in trouble. It doesn't happen very often. Very rarely do I ever see therapists getting in trouble for talking more honestly with their patients about drugs. No one's called a case to my attention in more than a year or two or three. It's the shrinks who are getting sued for what they do. But you have to be cautious. You have to make notes. You have to express your concerns in a legitimate way, and then you can refer people to websites. You can refer people to books and scientific articles. Am I answering your question?
Yeah, you are. I just think at some point it would help to put a piece together that says it is not your ethical requirement to medicate, and here's why.
Well, I've done that, and and that article does it.
And I think these are some of the things I wrote down as I start, you know, this, and I know that I've read, you know, I think nearly all your books. You know, my point is
about the article. You may not have read Rational Principles of Psychopharmacology. It's published in Comprehensive Psychology. It's published for psychologists.
That's awesome.
So you just may never have seen it because I write so much.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even remember what I've written.
Well, it's just that ethical part. You know, a psychiatrist told me that one day.
The ethics are on the side of the mental health professional who says, I'm concerned about your medications.
Right.
I'd like you to read some other things and take them to your psychiatrist or your nurse practitioner or your internist or whoever else is medicating. But the last person who will listen is the psychiatrist. They know nothing. They hold on with all their might to a know-nothing position.
Yep. Well, I think, you know, we have a lot in common on that. You know, I'm outspoken about drugging millions of kids for displaying these challenging behaviors that, you know, child development research documents just part of normal maturation process. But I'm still, like... I'm blown away constantly how, you know, the world of
mental health
wants to label these
symptoms. Well, it's horrible. I'm blown away too. It's one of the reasons why I'm doing so much work, more work on my website now, taking it away from working on book proposals, although I'm still hoping that I can get a book out there that sells well enough, you know, to get this across to people.
Yeah.
I'm with you. Let's keep thinking about what we can do. We could do a joint article just addressing the ethics of it and get it to psychotherapists. But again, they're mainly going to see it on the website probably.
Yeah, no, I think it's...
And we could do blogs about it. I'm really happy to address this issue. I think the ethical issues for psychologists are incredibly important, and I do think that the real ethic is your patient's well-being. You can't address your patient's well-being by changing the clinic or their psychiatrist. You can change your patient's well-being by giving them educational materials.
Well, and that's probably something, you know, this group needs to work on, because we know full well when you walk into a clinic, they've got every pamphlet from said pharmaceutical agency selling every drug, you know. We don't have those pamphlets in there telling the other side. And for a while, I actually left a pediatrician because I gave them a free book right before I left because they had like a shrine to ADHD behind the counter and wanted, you know, to diagnose her kid for it, even though we hadn't even asked. But I'm still dumbfounded how, you know, we still want to drug kids. It's like if they were not thinking clearly when they came to see you, the therapist, you know, how would a drug causing them to even, you know, have less control over their mind be a good thing, right? And it's like here we are trying to get them to connect these neurons and with some strong synapses, and, you know, we're drowning them in these, you know, pharmaceutically induced neurochemicals, and it's just, you know, I think I might have mentioned it before, but, you know, my late father was a drug and alcohol counselor in the VA for decades, and he guided these AA meetings on a weekly, if not, you know, daily basis. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to an AA meeting or what you think
of it.
Oh,
yeah, I think AA is great.
Yeah, I do
too. Know what's the literature like on, scientific literature on AA, but I think the principles are great. They're the exact same principles that I do in my therapy, really. I bring in God if somebody believes in God.
Yeah. I'm not knock on wood. I never had to go, but I, you know, personally know dozens of people and friends. You know, it's been life-changing.
Well, I've gone with friends. No, I haven't gone for myself. I've gone with friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm just, you know, I use this example because can you imagine if the requirement of AA was to come medicated, sedated, or drunk to the meetings? You know, it's the last thing they want. They want you to come sober so you can think clearly, right? And yet this seems to be the illogical approach we're taking in modern-day therapy. As we know, you come and see us, we do the intake, we diagnose you, but by the time you come back, you're going to be on drugs, you know? So I think one of the other questions, and you've done this, but I don't know how, my point is I just want to get an argument down so they get Bregan down to, you know, three main points that a clinician should cite explaining why pharmaceutical drugs are dangerous and it's, and just
well,
the
three, I can give you three main points. They may differ from minute to minute, but the first one is they're all neurotoxins. Textbooks on neurotoxicity actually describe each of these drugs as neurotoxins because they'll discuss neuroleptic malignant syndrome when they talk about the antipsychotics. They'll talk about serotonin syndrome when they talk about antidepressants. When they talk about the Ritalin and the amphetamines, they'll talk about all the amphetamine psychosis and everything else. Talk about lithium. Boy, that I know one neurotoxicology textbook that begins with lithium as its primary example. Yeah. So a point I may make in a blog at some point. But so, all right, the neurotoxins. How are neurotoxins going to work? Well, they only – that's the first point. They only work by harming your brain. So just as alcohol harms your brain and in the process will temporarily make you feel less anxiety, or just like taking stimulant drugs may so impair your imagination that you'll focus on your schoolwork and so on, they can only work by disabling your brain. A third good point would be that because of medication spellbinding, you'll be the last person to know you're worse off. Your wife will know you're not as loving. Your friends may notice you're robotic. People may say you're irritable, but you won't notice because the impairment from the brain disability makes it just really hard for us to perceive what's going on. So maybe one thing that will come out of this is I'll do a blog at some point, and I'll put those – what are the three main points? They're neuro – because I never thought of these, you know, this particular way. They're neurotoxins, period. They disable the brain.
It's a brochure I've put together for you. And you can put it to, I'll lay it out for you if we get it down. And then we can just make a free brochure that they can hand out at doctor's offices.
Yeah. Michael is so fabulous a designer, and I don't design at all. So this will be great. Those are the three points. Medication spellbinding. And why don't you do it up if you want, and we'll put your name on it and mine, and we'll try to get something out like that. Put sad-faced kids, put kids on it who don't know what's happening to them. And let's make it no bigger than a brochure.
Exactly.
Folks, you are here. This is happening more and more on my show. This happened the other day when Peter Gerzer was on. You're here while we're evolving new ways to communicate with the world. That was a theme with me and Peter Gerzer. How and what are we going to say about psychiatry to communicate with the world? But that was on a more intellectual, less concrete level. I like this better. This is really concrete.
Well, I'm not as intellectual as Peter. I've tried.
Peter's wonderful.
Yeah. I think, you know, for the children, elderly is the whole thing there. But let me ask you a slightly off the path question. wondered what you thought of this when all the news was coming out in the last few months. But after, you know, slowly coming to this realization that the overprescribing of opioids in the USA has led to, you know, this horrible illegal pharmaceutical black market and a heroin addiction. So in Ohio, where I live, it's just, you know, out of control. You know, people are dying. More people are dying from heroin than anything else, I think. You know, why can't the public or mental health world see that the prescribing of drugs and mental health practices are heading down that same path if we're not already here?
Well,
what do you think the difference is?
I think that there's many differences, but one of the biggest differences is industry. Industry has a much bigger commitment to substitutes for pain meds. They want people taking Prozac for pain. They want people taking Abilify for pain. They want people taking Tegretol for pain. And then they've got these other very remunerative, you know, Tramadol. They want people taking Tramadol for pain. When it's a mix of an analgesic and something that looks like an antidepressant in its basic formula. So I think that a good part of it is that the money, the biggest money right now, is not pushing the opiates, although there is big money pushing it. I think that people are much more suspicious of opiates because they're addictive. They don't know or think about the fact that every single sedative, sleeping pill, and tranquilizer from Ambien to Xanax is addictive. They don't think about that all the stimulants we give our kids are addictive, pretty much all of them, and the others are poisonous. They don't think about the fact that the definition of addictive is misleading because, in fact, all psychiatric drugs produce withdrawal problems. But they're not all addictive in the sense you want more and more of them because it's unbearable to take more and more of them. So with most psychiatric drugs, you can't take more and more of them because they're so noxious. So you end up just with these horrible withdrawal reactions. So I think there's a bunch of different reasons society is set up to even help people withdraw from these drugs because they are seen to be addictive. Nobody wants to admit the psychiatric drugs are addictive. And so we don't have any place to withdraw from them except from the benzos that are, and sometimes the stimulants, which are the more recognized as addictive. But there's a bunch of different reasons, but I think those are some of them. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. It just has confused me because I've been thinking a lot more about it in the last few months. And, you know, all the drugs are having that negative impact, you know, across our communities and societies,
right,
and things.
Right.
But it's like it took a full addiction, full-blown addiction, and, you know, hundreds, thousands of people dying, you know, every day, every week to really finally bring it to light. And it's like, okay, we learned it from this opioid effort, right? Why do we have to wait for 100, 1,000 people to die every week on the other ones? You know, if it's not needed, you know.
Oh, I think the deaths might even be that big. If you read what Peter Gertz is thinking and more of what we're looking at, I think there may, I mean, that would, God, is that an interesting question? Where are there more opioid deaths per week, or are there more combined psychiatric drug deaths per week? I think when I get off the show, I'll email Peter and see if he's thought about that, and I'll email a couple of other people.
Yeah, and I've so kind of wondered, too.
Because, you see, they don't get broadcast.
Even
if somebody commits murder on a psych drug, it isn't broadcast.
Exactly.
But if an addict commits murder, it might be broadcast, an ordinary addict.
Or if someone dies of heroin, we assume they're addicted to opioids and we connect it to, you know, pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, we don't even put in that the person was taking three psychiatric drugs at the same time that may have been what actually killed them.
Right. I'm curious where
this,
it will go.
The press is supporting the drug companies. So the media supports the drug companies. It's very interesting to me because I'm actually having new thoughts about all this. And so if you have a death from a psych drug, it doesn't get reported. If you have a murder or a suicide psych drug, it doesn't get reported, whereas the opioids are reported all the time.
Yeah. If you have a mass shooting, and the use of pharmaceuticals doesn't get reported. But I'm looking forward to I'm curious how it'll turn out when like some of these cities and small towns are suing pharmaceutical companies for how many drugs they pumped into the town. And I know when I first moved back to West Virginia a while back, I had a cracked tooth from the move, and I had to get a root canal that went awry, and they gave me Oxycontin for a cracked tooth. How many do you think I should have got?
Well, nowadays, probably none for the cracked tooth.
Well, this is like 10 years ago. How many do you think they gave me for having my tooth pulled that day?
I hope they gave you 5. Did they give you 30?
30.
Like, yeah.
Go figure.
They just wanted to make sure you got hooked.
Yeah. Well, I can't even use them. But so I got one last question for you, and this is something, too. I know you shared in your books and a lot of what you write, but I just think people don't hear enough. Why is therapy better or more effective when pharmaceutical drugs are not part of the picture?
Well, for one thing, humans don't thrive on neurotoxins. We'll do the three things. For another, they're all brain disabling. And for another, they impair a person's self-judgment, not just about the drugs, but they can impair it about anything. And it's hard to predict just where the impairment will be. People don't do well on psych drugs. The best they do is they hold in place and gradually get worse, in my experience. People who say they've been doing wonderfully on drugs rarely have grown a great deal over that time period. They're probably in the same marriage, same job, same problems. Drugs aren't what benefit human beings. What benefit us are improving our human relationships, our spiritual relationships, and getting the garbage out of our heads, which impair our human relationships. Does that make sense?
It does to me. I appreciate it. I've met so many, clinicians during my work, with ADHD and kids and all the talks, and so many just share how, they got into the career. They went into the career. It was a calling for them, and they just wanted to go in and help. And it's like now they're like, teachers tell me, clinicians tell me, it's like now I spend my whole day with zombies, and it's, to me, it's like I think they just want, there's enough out there that want to take back, and get back to that calling they had, and not be just going through the motions. And, and there's not enough, I know in the Columbus area, it's pretty hard to find a therapist,
Yeah.
And oftentimes it's, 3 to 4 weeks before you can see them again because they're all so booked, they're just not enough.
Well, I'm trying to address that now by developing a certificate program for being a – we haven't got what the name will be yet, whether it's going to be something like training or being a guide, but something completely out of the system where you can be trained by us and have this certificate. It doesn't grant you any professional authority, but if you're a social worker, you can put it up on your wall, and and if you're empowered to do therapy, you could say, and I've had this certificate from the Empathic Therapy Center to do empathic therapy. And what my hope is that this kind of a program will help the less expensive therapists do well, and then give people who just want to be parents or trainers or guides or anything else where they're going to help people without necessarily calling themselves professionals, a way to help people. And if they want to charge $25 and they're doing what we suggest, that's their business. I'm not even sure we'll monitor them because we suggest an educational program on how to help people.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get the essence of what it takes to help somebody, and it doesn't require a high school degree even. It requires some good solid life experience and a good sound ethics and a willingness to learn and lots of supervision. And that's what it requires to learn to do therapy, to help people, and maybe some good videos to watch. So that's one of the things I'm doing, and that would be interesting to get you involved with in some way. That's my next big project. We finished the first big one, which is the why and how to stop taking psych drugs, but it has a lot of therapy videos in it. So I'm really moving in all the directions you want, and I welcome you to move with me, and I will move you with you, and I'm hugely looking forward to seeing what kind of brochure you do. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. I want to leave them in your hands.
And the other thing I wanted to bring up, it's just, our country's pretty divided right now. And it's like, we live in this world where respectful debate and these differences of opinion, just lead to this dichotomy of waste, I know it's politics, it's religion. After Sunday, it's the college football playoff selection. Go Bucks. And mental health, we have the split, and I just wonder, and that's why we've tried to do with our, for the kids campaign that we were doing and traveling around. I can't tell you how many times we invited people from the other side to just come and talk, and at NYU we ended up getting a few, and it was interesting, but they didn't even want to stay around for the end to take Q&A and actually have a discussion. We let everybody present their different views when we were at NYU, and it just would be nice at some point to figure out, maybe it's not possible, better than me, you've been through it longer, but I'm just at some point just seems that we could all sit down and actually have a fruitful discussion or symposium
it's not possible,
It's just insane.
If you look back at the at slavery, for example, at the time our country was founded, it was considered radical to be an abolitionist. Very few people were abolitionists. There were two or three who were real founders who were abolitionists. Ben Franklin came to that position, a few others. I know that John Adams' wife was an abolitionist, and I think his brother was Samuel Adams, who was related to him, was an abolitionist. And in fact, there was an agreement among the founders not to discuss slavery in the new Congress, the U.S. Congress, after our president was elected and everything, Washington was a president. There was an agreement not to discuss it. And then Ben Franklin started to discuss it. Bless Ben Franklin. That man was just so amazing in so many arenas. So I think we're in a kind of situation like that, where we have to actually look at the need to abolish involuntary treatment. I'm calling for the abolition of giving psychoactive substances to children to control their minds or behavior. I think we have to come out and say there aren't two reasonable sides here. There aren't two reasonable sides to drugging our children. Gosh, we're over. Michael Corrigan, thank you so much for being on my show, and my wonderful audience, thank you so much for being there. Okay.
Thank you, Peter.
Bye, Michael. We'll be talking some more. Bye-bye.
Take care.